And we are still, Bershus, we are still in Chavis HaLovis Shah Avodas Elikim, all the way at the end of the Shah. And we are still in the middle of discussing the application of the various midas. I'm unapologetic about how much time we've been spending on this, because this is very important. And as I said last week, it's actually particularly appropriate in terms of preparing ourselves for the Yom Ha'Nayrayim. So we're still in the middle of his discussion of how to apply the various midas. We began last week discussing achzarius, the midah of callousness, insensitivity. What did you say the English one calls it?
Ruthlessness.
Ruthlessness.
It's the bottom of, the top of 344 in the English.
The top of 344. In the English edition, the top of 344. Yasher koyach. Where do we apply the midah of achzarius, of ruthlessness? So we began saying this last week. And of course, achzarius, callousness, insensitivity, is certainly from the midas that we generally avoid. Say it differently, this is what would be called a bad midah if it is used too much. It's meant to be used in a very small dosage. As we keep saying, every midah has its place when it's applied correctly. Achzarius is a type of midah that you're applying very minimally, but also has its place. Where does it have its place? Be parah min ha'rishayim, in taking retribution from the wicked. As we said, the Torah attitude is not one of tolerance toward criminals. Our first value is protecting. If we have compassion on criminals, we have even more compassion on people who are not criminals. They are the first who deserve our compassion. And therefore, the Torah has a very, very strict system for protecting society from criminals. And we don't have rachmanis on criminals. And it's like the Ramban says, right, that once we have rachmanis on criminals, then it's actually chazal. Having rachmanis on criminals is actually a form of cruelty on the innocent, because we will be encouraging it. We don't have something that we don't have any real deterrence in place.
Do you think there really is deterrent effect from punishment?
Yes. In societies, the more liberal the society gets, the more rampant crime becomes. In societies where there's no two ways about it, there's much less crime. The free extent to which crimes can be committed in liberal countries, right, are certainly a sign of that. Right? Now, having said that, we'll say that the Torah demands a very detailed approach. The Torah demands a very detailed approach, meaning, on the one hand, yes, the Torah puts down death penalty and other serious penalties for people who threaten society, for criminals. And it's something we believe in. On the other hand, the Torah makes it quite complicated to actually carry it out. Meaning, we are very, very slow to assume the person is actually deserving of the death penalty. If it turns out that the person is guilty, then there's no room for achmanis. But the Torah makes it very complicated to actually reach the conclusion that the person is deserving of this punishment. So on the one hand, we have to understand, Torah demands a certain sophisticated hashkafa, can't just take something at face value and run with it. On the one hand, the basic attitude is that we do not tolerate crime, and we are not looking to make life easier for criminals, etc. On the other hand, the Torah says, but wait, before you decide that a person is guilty, we have a lot of compassion before that can be decided. We put the witnesses, we put the court through a very, very rigorous process in order to actually decide that a person, say, deserves the death penalty, right? to the extent that actually the way it played out in reality was, we quoted this Gemara the other week, that says that a Bezdin that killed once in 70 years was considered a murderous Bezdin. So on the one hand, we have very strict punishments in place that hold society in check. On the other hand, when it comes down to it, we make it a very big deal to actually decide that the person is guilty. It's a very big deal. And in fact, the Chazon Ish says that a major part of the purpose of the punishments in the Torah, he notes this paradox. The Torah, on the one hand, is very, very strict in terms of the punishments it lays down. On the other hand, the Torah makes it pretty complicated for them to ever happen. So the Chazon Ish says that a major part of it is for the chinuch of society, meaning part of the purpose of, say, for example, you know that murder is killed, but a murderer is put to death, is for the purpose of the child in fourth grade who's learning this halacha, learns that murder is put to death. That's a major part of the purpose of the din. It's to create certain understandings from a very, very young age, right? That's another thing where unique, that you have children at the youngest age learning the basic halachas of the judicial systems. That's part of how we operate. They're learning Masechta Sanhedrin, they're learning Masechta Makkos, and they're learning these, they're learning it in the Chumash. We want them to know these things. That's actually part of the purpose. But that's the basic hashkafa. The basic hashkafa is that we reserve our compassion for people who are living the right way. We don't jump and say, let's have compassion on the people who are doing the wrong things and threatening everybody else. So that is the place for achzarius. A menachmin b'din. When the din calls for something, that is not the place to implement rachmanis. But we take it a step further. Let's say a person was sentenced to death. Let's say a person was sentenced to death. He shows us how contrite he is. He shows us how he really wants to change his way. Nothing doing. The sentence has to be implemented. Tshuva is between a person and Hashem. Nothing to do with Bezdin. But on the other hand, once the person is sentenced to death, again, you have the Gemara has a klal, a principle called, in terms of working out the halachas of exactly how the death sentences are implemented. And we know that there are four different death sentences of varying levels of strictness. And the Gemara works with the principle of whenever we are deliberating and figuring out the halachas of how does this death sentence apply, how does that death sentence apply, there's a klal called Berar Loi Misa Yafa. When there is a certain ambiguity, so you always go for the more, if you will, refined death. Even a step further, this is halacha that not many people know, but you know there are death penalties that are very severe in the Torah. But it's actually halacha, also in the Gemara, that before they put a person to death, they gave him something to drink that actually dulled his senses to an extent. I don't know exactly to what extent. It was apparently a very, very early version of some sort of sedative or anesthesia or something. So on the one hand, no, we don't have Rachmanis on the wicked. After we decide that we don't have Rachmanis, then we operate with Rachmanis. And also, when it comes to those who are acting destructively in the land. Now, there's two different points here. There are two different points here. A person did a crime and he's deserving of punishment. We have to implement that punishment. But then there's another aspect. There's an aspect of a person who is constituting a spiritual danger to others. And this is sometimes a spiritual danger to others. And this is an area where sometimes, again, we tend to get a little bit call it forgiving on Hashem's behalf. How bad is it already? Let's just be nice. But to really understand that spiritual danger, a person who's posing a spiritual threat is to be viewed as somebody who's posing a material threat, and even more, right? If we don't want to have, if we're going to deal toughly with a person, say, who is threatening the welfare, the physical welfare of people in the area, is a dangerous person to have around. And we're going to take even strict measures that we need to take to protect society. So if a person is posing a spiritual danger to the people around him, we also have to have that attitude. We can't have an attitude of, okay, it's fine, ish gefährlich. a person who's going to cause others to sin, we have to relate to that as a danger, no less than physical danger. This is also something that's sometimes tough to stomach. But when we're looking at the broader picture, not just looking at the here and now, we have to realize that, yes, spiritual danger is a very significant danger. It's a danger that's going to affect people. For physical danger only has implications on the next 100 years or so. Spiritual danger has implications on billions of years. It's on the person's eternal existence. And this is also something that has to be dealt with strictly. In fact, we go back once again. What is the worst? I won't say the worst aver in the Torah. We can't decide which is the worst aver in the Torah. But which is the aver in the Torah that is dealt with most severely? Most severely. The aver in the Torah that is dealt with most severely, more than any of the other death penalties, is what we call a mesis. Mesis or mediach. A person who wants to incite others to worship idolatry. How can he be so much worse? What happens to such a person? Skila. Right? He gets the death by stoning. So others will get death by stoning. Person who worships idolatry also. Person who's Mechal Shabbos also. How is he worse? Answer is that this person is a major danger to society. There are a few, right? We said before that it's complicated to actually carry out the death penalty. With a person like this, it's not so complicated. The terrorist skips a few steps. First of all, there's a din that ordinarily, this is part of what makes the death penalty so complicated to ever happen. In order for a person to warrant the death penalty, he has to be warned beforehand. Not only that, he has to be mekabel hasra'ah, meaning he has to actually respond and say, yes, I know, and I'm doing it anyways. And this makes it, how often can that happen, right? That's how we know, yes, there are death penalties in place, but it's very, very difficult for them to happen. The two witnesses have to be there. They have to tell him, do you know that if you do X, Y, Z, you'll be punished in this way? The person has to say, yes, I know, and I'm doing it anyways. With a mesis, we skip that. If a person is trying to get others to serve Avodah Zarah, there's no warning. This is the one case where we say that the halacha is that we hide edim. He doesn't even know that they're there. We hide witnesses. They're hiding behind the fence. They hear him trying to convince somebody else to go serve Avodah Zarah, and he can be put to death on that basis. Now, we have to stress these things because as much as we stress compassion, like we're saying, compassion is a very, very central mida in the Torah, central mida for a Jew. So many of the mitzvahs revolve around developing our compassion, etc. But, like we said before, a good mida that's meant to be used 97% of the time turns into a bad mida once you use it in the 98%. And part of being a true servant of Hashem is the ability to even keep our good midas in check. You have to realize that. Even our good midas have to be limited to their 97%. And here is where the Torah is calling for the true servant of Hashem has to be able to operate against this nature. The Torah the whole time is encouraging us to develop the compassionate nature, but to be able to turn around and say, now is one of the 3% where we have to go against our grain and implement a different midah. Let me ask something.
Yeah, see, my understanding is that most deaths or murders that occur are interfamily, where someone gets in an argument with someone, they have a gun in the house, and they shoot them. Okay, so that's not death penalty is going to help there because it's not a premeditated thing. Now, someone who's doing what you say, who wants to go out and get other people to worship Avodah Zarah, okay, so that is like a premeditated thing, where a person can think logically. They're not in the heat of an argument or something, you know? So I don't know. I think the studies show that it doesn't really have such a huge deterrent effect because most of the murders that occur are like overwhelming emotion and nobody's thinking logically, oh, I could get the death penalty at that point.
Why would a person be put to, here's a question, why would a person earn a very severe penalty for something that happened in the heat of the moment, in an emotional reaction in the heat of the moment? So, okay. First of all, let's again come back to the Hasra'a aspect. Let's come back to the Hasra'a aspect, the warning aspect, right? That the Torah says the person has to be warned. But you know what? There's actually outside of that, the Torah tells Beis Din to that in cases, there's the protection of society aspect. Let me put it this way. If, let me ask you this. Is it common for people to lose their temper?
Yes.
Is it common for people to kill people when they lose their temper?
No.
No. So in other words, there is, at the end of the day, still a certain understanding of what you do and what you don't do, even when you completely lose yourself, right? If you think of most of us, what will happen when someone within our frame of reference completely loses themselves? They'll scream at the top of their lungs, right? They won't pull out a knife and stab a person who's close to them. Now, when it is clear in society that this is something that just can never, ever happen, I dare say that in many cases, I'm not saying klalim here. I'm not saying it was very hard to talk generalities here. But I dare say that in many cases where a person would respond like that, it's because they grew up in an environment where that sort of thing does happen. Sometimes you have a person who is, okay, perhaps somewhat insane. Such a case, we have provisions for such cases. Okay, fine. But generally speaking, when you hear about these, what how do you put it, the interfamily occurrences, they're growing up in a certain circle, in a certain neighborhood, in a certain reality where such a thing is not unthinkable, right? This is exactly what we're trying to avoid. We want to create a reality where in no circle is such a thing unthinkable, right? And this is when the Torah is being lived all across the Jewish people, all across Eretz Yisrael, in the right way. Nobody has seen a movie which encourages that, inspires them to understand that that's how you react to, right, such an occurrence. I saw an article. I read an article once. I'm not proud of the secular things I've read in my life, but a few of them have stuck with me and provided me with certain hashkafic bases. A person describing, this was a reformed criminal, someone had insulted his girlfriend. And he went after that person and shot him. And he said, he shot the person and felt the manliness of no one is going to insult my girlfriend. He said it was only when the cuffs were slapped on that he really chopped what happened. And this person wrote that he was inspired by a movie called The Godfather. I didn't see that movie, Baruch Hashem, so I don't have that inspiration. But I will say that, yes, very often these types of things that you're describing are the result of the exposure itself, are the result of that this is something that can happen, right? But when we cultivate a society where certain things simply cannot happen, there will be much, much, much less of such things. And that's part of the point we're making. The Torah is trying to create a sterile environment. That's all part of the, all this is part of the reason why the Torah wants us to be living in a sterile environment without exposure. Right? People think, so you saw some movies. What's so bad? What's so bad is that it is adapting your frame of reference. It's things become, even if you would still never do them, but you could hear it. Right? You can see it. That's already a problem. That's something that already conflicts with the sensitivities that the Torah wants us to have. Okay. I'll give you another example. The truth is that this is somewhere where the Chavos Halevavos is going. There is this can be approached from a number of angles, but I'll just give another example. Unless by that time a few more examples will have fallen into my mind, but we all know the concept of a saita, right? A woman who goes through the whole process in the Beis Hamikdash to prove whether she had been disloyal or not. Okay, now the Gemara says, "Haloya saita bekilkula yazir atzma minayay." In the Torah, the parsha of the Saita is immediately followed by the parsha of Nazir. The Nazir is a person who abstains from wine and other things, right? And the Torah says, why is one immediately followed by the other? Because if a person actually saw a saita go through the process in the Beis HaMikdash, and it played out how these things play out, he should respond to that by becoming a nazir and by abstaining from wine. Now, the question asked is, I believe the Brisker of asked this question. He said, why does he need to abstain from wine? He saw her pop, right? And he the man involved pop wherever he is. So he saw her pop. This is the last person I asked to abstain from wine. People, person who didn't see should abstain from wine, right? Follow the question?
Right.
Why are we telling the person who actually witnessed the terrible end to abstain from wine? The Brisker Rav made a point that's a very fine psychological point, but this is all coming back to the point of understanding the purity that the Torah wants us to live in. It's similar to the concept of Amalek cooling the bath. A person growing up in Eretz Yisrael in the time of the Beis HaMikdash should be living in a reality where he never ever heard of such a thing. It appears theoretically in the Torah, should a person do such a terrible thing, this is what happened. But he's never actually heard of such a thing. Something that's never happened in his life. He was never exposed to it because really there isn't such a thing. It's going on in other countries. I have very little contact with other countries. I'm supposed to be in contact with other countries, right? Once a person was actually exposed to it, he saw the terrible end, but it's something that could happen. It became a part of reality. Now, even though it's mamish like the mashal with Amalek with the bath, right? There's a boiling hot bath that nobody dares jump into. Amalek jumped into it, right? Jumped into it, got burned, got scalded. But it has already had a certain effect on the mind. Whereas up till now, it just can't happen. It's not realistic that it would ever happen. Now, it could happen. There will be terrible results, but it could happen. That is it's a subtle point, but as far as the Torah is concerned, it's a significant point as far as the sensitivities the Torah wants us to have. Okay. This was something of a tangent, but an important one. Now, it's for this reason that also there are averis that are not about threatening society in the physical sense, but averis that are, like we said before, mesis is the paradigm of a spiritual threat to others. And that is why the concept of a pirzah, right, in the times when Klal Yisrael was really operating optimally, Beis Din had the license to take certain measures if a person did something that would dull the sensitivities of the person around him, of the people around him. They could respond with very severe measures. Because part of what we're trying to do is to protect the spiritual environment. And here also is another place where we say, this is actually a time to apply cruelty, if you will, when it comes to protecting the spiritual standards of our society. Now here again, like we said before, we never turn it into a situation where, okay, then everything goes. The challenge of a Torah Jew is to live with a lot of balance. Balance means being able to balance different values when they come together in the right way. I'll just give you for example, right? You can have a situation where you have in a school a child who is constituting a threat to the other kids in the class. In the spiritual sense, he might be exposing them to things that will be dangerous for their spiritual well-being. And here again, as we said, the basic approach is not, well, we still just have to be nice, etc. No. We have to protect others from the spiritual threat. At the same time, and this is something that the Gedolim are always yelling about, we never have the right to just take the easy way out and say, okay, we'll get rid of the kid and that will be that. No. There are a few stories to this effect. On the one hand, we don't just say, well, okay. But on the other hand, there are a few such stories to this effect. There was a story where the heads of a school came to Rav Shach with a kid who was becoming a problematic influence, and they wanted to remove him from the school. So Rav Shach sat down to hear the details, and they were describing the details, and they're telling him, you know, he does this, he does that, this happens, that happens. And then Rav Shach started questioning them about what's the background? What's the story in the kid's family? What's the story? Are there Shalom Bayis problems with his parents? Is there this? Is there that? And the Rebbe or the principal, whoever it was like, well, I don't know. I never really looked into that. So Rav Shach said, you have to get rid of him. You have to get rid of you. You're a danger to the school. Or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, a little bit of a different direction, but similar, where also they came to him asking, he said, did you really do everything you can? And they said, yes, we tried everything. So Shlomo Zalman said to the principal, how many times did you fast? So what do you mean you tried everything? Or, also in the other direction, so meaning, yes, we do have the approach that sometimes we'll need to be insensitive and cruel in order to protect the spiritual standards around. But at the same time, that sensitivity, that cruelty itself, when it's called for, has to be fed by Rachmanis. Yes, it's a difficult business getting the balance right. But this is something that the Torah expects. Also in the other direction. Decide it's time, yes, to eject the kid. So this was a ma'aseh with the Chafetz Chaim, where he decided he had to eject a Talmid from the yeshiva because he was bringing in literature that was dangerous, a bad influence on the other boys. And he decided he had to eject him. Now we can certainly assume that the Chafetz Chaim went through all the processes that we described. He ejected the boy, told him you have to leave. The boy asked, can I sleep in the yeshiva tonight? And he said, no. You have to leave immediately. He wasn't willing to have in the yeshiva anymore. Okay, the boy left not knowing where he's going to go. In that moment, the Chofetz Chaim said, and you're going to be my guest tonight. You're going to be my guest tonight. Took him home, fed him, put him to bed. But then this boy told this story. He said that, he fell asleep. Guest in the Chofetz Chaim's home. He said, but then what happened in the middle of the night was something that really changed him. He said, in the middle of the night, he heard the Chofetz Chaim tiptoe into the room. And he made believe that he was sleeping. And he felt the Chofetz Chaim cover him with his coat. It was a chilly night. And the Chofetz Chaim covered him with his coat. This was a boy that he had kicked out of the yeshiva that evening, right? But does that mean you're putter from compassion? It means that you have to do what you have to do. It does not mean that doesn't exempt you from compassion on the personal level. It's a tricky business. But we do come back to the point that we can't just take an approach of, okay, the Torah just wants us to be nice. We have to understand that when we have things to protect, whether on the material or spiritual level, it's serious. Chofetz Chaim, it's also known that Chofetz Chaim, right, was the model, the paradigm of Shmiras Haloshim, right? There was one person, one Jew that he said Yimach Shemoy about. One Jew. This was a man, I forgot what his name was, Roy to something. They used to call him Red something. I guess he has a red complexion. This man had attempted to draw the Chofetz Chaim away from the yeshiva as a boy. To draw him away from the yeshiva and to get him, to get him off. He saw the Chofetz Chaim's intellectual abilities, thought that he'd have a great future, I guess, out there somewhere else. And he tried to pull the Chofetz Chaim away. And for the rest of his life, Chofetz Chaim, whenever he would mention this person's name, he would say, Yimach Shemoy. It was one person. Okay. We move on. There are another two midas that we have. Hagaiva v'anava. Arrogance and humility. Okay, and of course, here also we know which do we generally consider the mida to be using and which is the one to generally be avoided. But here again, The Chavetz Chaim is here is not coming to explain us the problems with the bad midas. He's coming to show us the application of every mida. This mida in its 97% and this mida in its 2-3%. Where is the place of gaiva? Mekayim ha-gaiva va-gaiva. When should a person act arrogant? Act haughty. When you encounter those who deny Hashem, or those who are straying from Him, do not lower yourself before them, so that you should not appear as justifying them, and following their decadent attitudes. That is the place to unleash the mida of haughtiness. We generally keep it locked up, the lock and key, right? But here's the place to unleash it. To show how you completely reject their attitudes and how you scorn them. Just as you know about Mordechai and Haman. What this means is as follows. This does not mean, again, we live in a complicated reality today. We live in a reality where there are so many people who are away from Hashem and from His Torah through no fault of their own. And that creates complicated realities that they didn't really have to deal with in earlier times. We're dealing with other things. But let's understand the point. So just give an example. Let's say you have relatives who don't appreciate what a frumi you are. They don't appreciate what a frumi you are. Whether they're religious but don't believe in your standards, don't believe in your being so into it, they believe you should be more normal. Whether they're completely not religious. And when you get together with them, there can sometimes be a certain sense of, you know, they're making fun of the frumi. And you kind of laugh apologetically and just kind of try to maintain a low profile. This is what he's saying not to do. Not to be apologetic. This is the time to act with pride. Yes. To have what we might call a superiority complex. And this is not the time to be humble. This is not the time to be humble. Now, should you be... So he is talking about... He's talking about a case where, yeah, I have a person who is trying to put you down to scorn you. And here, no, don't lower your head. Don't lower your head. You have to show, no, I consider myself above you. I consider myself above you. Now, this is very tricky. Again, this is one of those things that becomes very tricky when it comes to how to actually implement it in practice. But let's have the attitude. The attitude is that we do not want to be conveying, you know, I'm from and I'm kind of like, you know, when I meet with these people, I'm going to feel apologetic and just kind of hide. No. I'm on top, and I feel for you, right? I wish you luck. I hope you'll discover it one day, but I'm not apologetic. I'm not going to be lowering my head. This is the place to feel haughty and to cultivate pride, to cultivate pride. To say this in a little bit of a more refined way. Again, this is the type of thing that has to be decided very much on an individual basis. But when you have these questions of you have the conflict between, so you have family who's not living at your level. And there's always the complicated questions of how to relate, how to interact. So certainly, to whatever extent we can, if we can be warm, welcoming, try to share with them the warmth of Yiddishkeit. And even if you're not evangelizing, you have to have a good handle on the situation. Sometimes just maintaining a warm relationship without trying to directly influence, without trying to bang them over the head, sometimes that's the best way to go about it, either in the hope that ultimately they'll come closer or in the hope that wherever they are, you have to understand that having a right attitude toward Torah life is much better than having a wrong attitude toward Torah life. So if we can at least help them have a right attitude toward, that's an extent of kiruv, even if they'll never actually end up changing anything in their lives. But it sometimes becomes complicated once it is a question of, like we said before, influence on your children. there it becomes very, it becomes complicated. And here again, I'm saying we're not, there's no way to give rules of thumb when it comes to this. Every case has to be figured out on an individual level, but often it very much boils down to this. This is a more subtle aspect of what the Chavis Olam is saying. Yeah. Can we afford to maintain an ongoing relationship with them when our children are going to be exposed to them? Sometimes the answer has to be no. And this is another aspect of, in a more subtle way, a certain callousness. We're not talking about doing anything actively. We're not talking about insulting them. But we may be talking about what might be a painful process of trying to, in a quiet way, without making statements, to minimize the getting together, etc. Sometimes we might have to do that. But sometimes what makes it possible to yes get together is if you're capable of keeping the dynamics such that your children see that you are the mashpia. You are the holding the higher end of the interaction, of the dynamic, of the relationship. If it's such that they're just going to see that those relatives are going to be able to make fun of you and you're going to be just meekly lowering your head, better to keep away. But if it's possible to create a situation where, again, without putting them down, but you could be the warm, compassionate one, superiority can come across in that way also. Superiority can come across in a way of care, but very clearly that I'm on top, right? That I'm on the top. Hey, gaiva, that's right. This is what the Kodesh Avos is telling us, kosher gaiva. If this is something that the children can clearly sense, they have a relationship, a warm relationship with them in which we are the ones who are caring for them, if you will. Yes, with a certain condescending attitude that comes across in a warm way. It's tricky, but there is such a thing. Then that can sometimes make it easier to, yes, maintain a relationship. Now, again, this is very tricky. Each case has to be divided, discussed on an individual basis. Very, very hard to give rules about these things. But we're coming back to the understanding that haughtiness has its place when it comes to, yeah, I do consider myself to be in a superior place than the other person. Am I judging them? Not necessarily judging them. Maybe my circumstances were different, et cetera, et cetera. But right now, objectively, in terms of the reality, yes, I'm in a better place, and I'm very clear about that. Okay. Now, Chavis HaVavis is talking about it in a much more blatant terms, right? Show your scorn for them. So he's not talking about the cases we're talking about. He's talking about the unusual cases in his time of a person who decided that he's going to, when you had in the early time, people who started developing the philosophies of why you don't need to keep the Torah so much, etc., or the one Jew who succumbed and became and converted because he wanted the material benefits involved. And then when he meets other Jews, he's ridiculing them. And the ability to, yes, to be able to put this person down and show you are a pathetic weakling. And yeah, you might look all good today, now that you were welcomed into their society and you're doing much more, you're materially much better off than we are now, etc. But we look at you as a pathetic weakling, even though I'm wearing rags. This is where it was relevant in those times. This is something very relevant. I'm not going to bow my head before that, you know, the one convert in the neighborhood who now is walking around feeling all superior because he's accepted by their society. He's now a part of them. No. When I meet him, I look down upon him. This is the place for gaiva.
Well, can I just say something? As a Baal Tshuva, I have to say that when I became from, what turned me away more from Yiddishkeit was the gaiva that I would hear about how that's not kosher and it's not kosher and farm Jews don't know nothing. Like that gaiva, I'm like, that, there's like, you could draw people with honey or you can push them away. Like a person who knows what they're doing is right and they're in a better place can exude that without the scorn and the derision, because I don't think that that really accomplishes anything. I mean, that's my experience and the experience of my friends who were sort of in the same boat. Oh. Like the more derision we heard, of other forms of Judaism, which I understand. Once you're from, you can say it to other frummies. But if you're saying it to people who aren't, just going to push them away further.
I don't think you should be saying it to other people.
Okay. Well.
Okay. So let's address your question. You're asking again. This is bringing out the complicated nature of this reality in our times, of today's reality. It's also bringing out some of the more painful aspects of today's reality. It's true. I agree with what you said, but let's break it down. So first of all, let's come back to what we said before. The Chavis HaLavis is talking about scorn, because he was talking about, like we said before, that earlier reality of when you had the one person in the neighborhood decided to become a convert, and he knows exactly what he did, and everybody else understands exactly too. This comes back to what we said before, that there are ways of conveying, of like you said before, exuding the understanding that we are in a more superior way without the scorn, right? This is what I meant when I said, sometimes it can come across actually in a warm way, but with a very, very clear understanding of I am in a better place than you, and I'd love to help you get to that place too. So that's true. That's true. And also, yes, to put it bluntly, it's certainly not something we want to be telling. You know what? It comes from, there's a very, very challenging piece here. This is challenging when we're talking about irreligious people. It's also challenging when we're talking about religious people, because also for us, one of the challenging aspects of Yiddishkeit, the people who are living in the Golos and are living very, very far from the true standards that the Torah had, I'm talking about the firmest among us, that were actually being lived in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, is to be able to really reach a realization that things in my life are very far from what they ought to be. It's very, very difficult. And therefore, you can't come to a person and demand that of you. True. And here's what we'll say. It's certainly not an approach to taking kiru. It's true. It's true. Yet, we will say that once, and yeah, it's true. When we are interacting with the Jews of different levels, we have to be very, very attuned to what we're doing. But nevertheless, we do have to have this understanding for ourselves. We do have to have this understanding for ourselves, and I'll take a step further, even though this is a little less popular. We have to make it clear to our children also, even though it might seem unpalatable. But we'll say this. It's like we said before, right? We talked before about the need to balance protecting society with at the same time inserting compassion into it, right? We said before, sometimes you have to take cruel measures, but at the same time be compassionate. The cruelty has to be cushioned in compassion, which is a very, very delicate and tough business, but that's what the Torah demands of us. So when it comes to this also, we cannot just take an approach of everybody's fine. Take an approach of everybody's fine, we create very, very hazy standards. We have to be able, on the one hand, to have a very, very clear picture of what is right and what is wrong. On the other hand, we have the concept of seeing the good in everybody, right? Of being able to relate to the value of each Jew as an neshama. And here again, this is not usually, we're talking about the midas that are meant to be implemented in that 3% of the time. And therefore, we're talking in different tones that we usually speak, because usually we're focused on the 97% of the time. But we do have to understand that seeing the good in every Jew, being able to appreciate the beauty of every Jew, has to come after we have a very, very clear picture of what's right and what's wrong. The basis has to be when we're talking about ourselves, not when we're talking about how do we actually interact with other people, how do we influence other people. When we're talking about ourselves, when we're talking about our children, I'm sorry, this is not popular, but it does have to start with a very, very clear understanding of this is right, this is wrong, right? Then you can move on to the stage of, they don't know that it's wrong. They weren't exposed to the right things. They're not as lucky as we are. We can have compassion on them. But these have to be tweaking. If the basis starts with, look, different people serve Hashem in different ways. That's a very, very dangerous message if that's the basis of the message. But the basis has to be whether we like it or not. And again, we're in a society that works against this. We're in a society that doesn't like to believe in absolute right and wrong. The Torah does believe in absolute right and wrong. So we do have to have clear for ourselves, this is right, this is wrong. When we're talking about children, when we're talking about Talmidim, we do have to convey, this is right, this is wrong. The next more sophisticated level is, okay, they don't know. who knows if they, the challenges that they're dealing with, actually put them in a higher place than me. That's something, it's a sophisticated way of thinking. And when we reach the right level, we can even think in those terms. But it's certainly not something, if we're going to be saying that in the very basic level, before we even start teaching about right and wrong, we say, 1 minute, you see any other person, you have to consider that maybe they're really greater than you. Then the child says, all right, so what do I need? Why do I need to keep Shabbos? I can become great in other areas. I'll be very, very nice, right? When it's convenient. So, yeah, it's a little painful. It's a little tough to swallow, but it does have to start with, this is right, this is wrong. And then we can go from there to the more sophisticated understandings of being able to understand them, being able to relate to them, being able to even see the beauty in them, as long as we're not smearing what's right and what's wrong. Now, there was a question sent here. There was a question. Okay, a few questions being sent here. I can only do with one at a time. 1 minute. I'm sorry. I'm trying to access the questions. I have a, maybe one time I'll ask somebody to show me all the ins and outs of Zoom chat. Okay. What if the relatives are Shema Shabbos? Okay, we're past the time, so please don't feel uncomfortable to get up and leave, and I won't be insulted. Also, if you weren't pleased by the things I'm saying. What if the relatives are Shema Shabbos, but they're different hashkafa of life? How do you maintain the relationship with children being their cousins and not separate, and thereby also hurting the grandparents who want all the relatives to be close? Right, right. This is one of those questions. The question is, what do I mean by different hashkafas? The question is, what do we mean by different hashkafas? Sometimes different hashkafas means everybody is at the same level of intense dedication to Avodas Hashem. Just that they approach it in different ways. One approaches it from a Hasidish angle, one approaches it from a Litvish angle, one approaches it from a Sfardish angle. Here, we have no problem conveying that people who are dedicated to Avodas Hashem, and they're putting Hashem's desires before their own desires, right? And they are following people who are greater than them, etc. We have no problem with saying, this is the way we do things, that's the way they do things, this is the beauty of the way we do it, this is the beauty of the way they do it. That we should not have a problem with that. If it comes to an issue of different standards, so it's true, it is a sticky business, and we don't have the liberty of just going in one direction or the other. I said before, there was a maestro with Reb Meir Chodesh, bring the example of hurting grandparents who want all the relatives to be close. There was a, again, I'm stressing, feel free if you want to leave, but it's true. This is, we might say that in our generation, we are being demanded to maintain certain balances that earlier generations weren't challenged with. And part of the beauty of our role as a generation, kind of like at the tail end of Jewish history, is the ability to be able to strike these balances. There was a maisa with a boy, I believe from South Africa, had become a Baal Tshuva and grew a lot. Ended up in the Chevron Yeshiva, right? Cream of the crop. And as Pesach vacation was coming, and he was going to be going home. And he was preparing himself for different challenges he was going to face at home. And he was called in by the legendary Mashkiach, Reb Meir Chodesh, who told him, you know that when you're going home, you're going to be facing challenges. So the Bacha said, oh yes, I'm very aware of that. So Reb Meir Chodesh said, which challenges do you think I mean? So the boy said, well, Kashrus is going to be a challenge, and how to navigate Shabbos is going to be a challenge. And so Reb Meir Chodesh said, no, it's not the challenge I'm referring to. I'm referring to the fact that now you're going to be coming home feeling much superior to your parents. Are you going to be able to honor them properly? That's the challenge I'm referring to. So, right, how do you maintain it? You need a lot of sensitivity and a lot of chachman. It's very difficult to give rules of thumb in these things. But on the contrary, step number one comes back, step number one, maybe it's step number seven, but it comes back to the point that we were saying before. To be able to give over to our children a confidence in the life that we lead, right? A pride in the life when they lead. If that can be instilled correctly, if that can be instilled enough, then we can afford to be in these other places. If we see that our children are starting to feel inferior because they're the frumis, it's something we have to address. But if we're capable of instilling in them the confidence and the pride without putting anybody else down, then you have it in place for you then, for yourself. So very much, we might take a step back. In the Chavetz Chavavos put it in the very, very stark reality of those days where Jews knew that they're supposed to be frum. And if you had the one or two people in the community who changed his lifestyle, he knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly why you were relating to him the way you are. In today's reality, we can take a step back and say, forget the scorn part. But yes, focus on the gaiva part. The gaiva doesn't have to come with the scorn. But the pride is something very, very, very important. The pride in understanding that, yes, we sacrifice more comforts than many other people do because we want to be living closer to Hashem and to appreciate the significance, the value of being closer to Hashem, and to also be telling the children, you know what, we're going to be getting together with these relatives. They have a lot to learn from you. It can be very warm. It can be very welcoming. It doesn't have to be with a form of, look at them. Let them see. Let them see. Let them see what you children behave like, right? So, again, it has to be dealt with on a very individual basis. It's very sticky. It's very tough. It's often very painful. But all we'll say is that the answer is not to just decide on one direction or the other. We have to put in the efforts to try to somehow balance it all. And that can be tough. You have to be close with these sort of situations. It's very important to be close to somebody, a Rav, a wise person who knows your family well and is able to actually provide the individual guidelines. There's another question here, but again, I'm offering anybody who wants to leave, please. Years ago, schools and camps were able to be mixed of all types of backgrounds, including Beis Yaakov. I was just reading how in Beis Yaakov of Lower East Side with Moshe Feinstein had all kinds of backgrounds and nobody was hurt. People understood where each one was coming from, but they all got along. I went to Camp Sternberg and all types were there and it worked. I mean, some were more from, others more modern Orthodox, aren't as makbid on hashkachas. Now it comes back to the same question. We can't just address these things in a general way. We have to say, look at the reality. If your children are not going to be affected at all, then you have nothing to worry about. It's not a question like we don't have to get into how is it done today, how is it done then. There are probably problems with the way it's done today, problems with the way it's done then. It's very, very difficult on the institutional level to get things right. Very difficult. And sometimes you have phenomena where there will be like a pendulum that it's one extreme at one time, and then they respond to the challenges of that, and it goes to the other extreme the other time, and then they have to start working back in the other direction. So it's very difficult to say, well, then it was this way, now it's this way, which is the proof that it's the right way? It comes back to dealing with the challenges of having everybody together. It'll pose the challenge of, is there going to be negative influence? We can't get away from the fact that that's a problem. The challenge of starting to divide everybody is that you do create this divisiveness. We can't get away from the fact that that's a problem. So it really comes back to having a good handle on the situation. What are the effects? But the point here is to appreciate that the effects are important, not just to say, let's just have everybody together and whatever. We can't just afford to say whatever. We do have to have a handle, a finger on the pulse, a handle on the situation. What are the effects? But yes, it's true. We have to be conscious of the fact that becoming exclusive can cause serious problems. And ignoring the dangers and everybody together can also cause serious problems. This is part of the complexity of our times. Was there another question that we missed here? I'm not so good at navigating this. I don't see any more questions. So forgive me if I missed something. Okay, this is I'm just going to state that the subject we discuss now is a very tough subject. I usually try to say it before beginning this year, that there should be no pitfalls that result as a result of this year. And I pray that that was the case now. I hope that things were clear. And anybody can feel free to contact me if you want further clarification. But again, I was coming back to the point that many of these things, lamaisa, do have to be addressed on an individual basis with an awareness of the stakes on both sides. And there are stakes on both sides. Agut
avach. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you.